Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And the Raptors with a well-deserved day off, back in action at home against the Utah Jazz on tomorrow, I guess. Let's bring in Michael Grange, Sportsnet's own. And Michael, I want to start with this, because we started the show talking about Novak Djokovic and hotels, and Stephen told this great story, the worst hotel he's ever stayed at. You've, I'm sure, also stayed at some horrible hotels during your reporting days. Does one stand out above the others?
Yeah, a couple of bad ones. But the only time I was ever really kind of concerned about where I was staying was in Jacksonville, Florida. I was, for some reason, they're covering an NFL game. I don't know why. And I was staying in a Days Inn, and it was like kind of strip mall-y in the middle of nowhere-ish and very low grade. And, just not clean. And it's the only time I've gone, man, I wish this thing had more than one floor. Like, I just did not feel comfortable being at street level. And, there was like stray dogs walking around. There's a lot of rusted out cars. I always liked to kind of, there was no gym in it. I like to get out for a run. I was like running around going like, I don't know, man. This might not be
running for your life. Nothing's better motivation than somebody chasing you.
It just felt like one of those places where, like, some angry locals would say, "What are you doing here?" And then make me try to explain myself and then find a reason to hit me. That's how it felt.
All right. You didn't have the cats in crates like Stevens did in the.
It had a very angry Leonard Skinner vibe, I guess.
Yeah. That's their home, right?
Allman Brothers, but none of the good stuff. Yeah.
All right, I get you. Yeah, good doc on Netflix on Leonard Skinner, by the way. All right, so the Raptors are quite good now. Again, I've said that before, and a lot has happened though in 35 games this season. I know we've only seen the top eight fully healthy once this season. How much more do we know about what this team is today?
We know a little bit more, and we'll get a chance to learn a lot more, and it'll start soon enough. I mean, Utah, I guess, is going to be short a couple of guys, but then the Suns are in not too long after that. And I think that's been the question kind of in the background all season. I think we've even talked about it before, is if you have in Pascal Siakam and Fred VanVleet, and I've always kind of put OG Anunoby in a little bit different category, because he's such a specific role player that's high-end kind of in that role. Can he grow beyond it? I'm sure he wants to, and he can. But, if your team kind of hovers around Siakam and Fred VanVleet, how good is it? And, you're getting a feeling like it's pretty good. And then for bonus points, you're getting, Scottie Barnes is a lot better than anyone thought he would. And maybe he can be, a real impact player a lot sooner than maybe, most people might have expected. So all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, maybe there is, all of a sudden you've got a team with Fred VanVleet, who's kind of at an all-star type level, whether he gets the nod or not. You got Siakam playing the best basketball of his career. Can he sustain this? We haven't seen it for a long time. That's kind of all-star-ish. You have Scottie Barnes, who's, I think, a guy can be projected to be an all-star. Like, I don't think that's all that hard. And you have an elite role player who still has some upside in OG Anunoby. Well, that's the core of something pretty good. And then the question becomes, how do you augment it? How rapidly do you try to augment it? And, what steps do you take to do that? Or do you just let it bake a little longer? So I think, it's been a long time coming, and it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out over the next sort of 10, 15 games.
Yeah. Oh, there's all kinds of reasons, for it. Like, it's, you can kind of understand why it's been a long time coming, right? There's been a lot of variables, some of which unanticipated, right?
So they just haven't played together. I mean,
that would be the big one for a whole bunch of reasons, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think when they played the Clippers that started this win streak, I think that was the first time they only had one, and Scottie Barnes missed that one with the sore knee. That was the first game they'd only had one of their top eight players unavailable. And then they won that one. Then the last three games has been the only time this year they've had their top eight players available. So,
But Mike, before we, but you know, kind of getting into that conversation about, you know, do you augment and do you do it this year, and or, you know, do you, is this the foundation on which you build something? Where, right now, like with what you've seen in an Eastern Conference that is kind of murky between what, 4-11, you know, or 3-11, it's you know, there's a lot of kind of, you know, teams that, there's teams that have underachieved, there are, you know, teams that, but you know the Raptors are in a place where, you know, they could rise up to 4 or 5 or 5 pretty easily in that context. But when, like, what do you think they are in, if you look at the East as a whole right now, what are they?
I think they're, you know, I think the East has 4 really good teams that you could all see in an NBA Finals. And then after that, it's who knows, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think they're, what, 2 games out of 5th. Let's have some fun. Let's say they get to 5th. Let's say Miami stays in 4th. And you got Kyle Lowry, you know, get all the Kyle Lowry in Toronto games you could ever want at that point, you know, in the first round. So, I think they're a little cut below, you know, those really quality teams, you know, the superstar laden teams, be it Miami or Milwaukee or Brooklyn. You know, I'm forgetting one in there, but after that, you know, I think they're exploitable in some ways. I mean, I think they're, you know, it's nice that they're all kind of big and the same size, but there's no rule against having a really good 7-footer. Like, they're always handy. And, you know, I think the lack of depth at point guard is a problem, right? Like, I mean, if Fred VanVleet actually sprains an ankle, God forbid, you know, you're in deep, deep trouble. So I think those would be some, you know, it's probably easier to find some help at backup point guard than a really big, good quality big. But as you kind of look at the profile of this team, you know, if everything works in your favor, I think they'd be a dangerous first round team for sure.
You mentioned the backup point guard thing, and yeah, I mean, perhaps this is too early in the conversation to be having this conversation, but Malachi Flynn is out of the rotation, and yeah, I get, what was he, 29th overall pick, but one pick after him, Desmond Bane's been a real nice player, Michael. that feels like, I know, you don't rely on someone to be a rotation player at 29, but they just missed having a really nice player one pick after that.
Yeah, really good player. Yeah, no, that's worth noting, right? And you know, a rare miss, I think, from the Raptors. And it's been really interesting watching Malachi Flynn. I mean, I remember vividly seeing him early in the season last year and going, "Wow, this guy's really crafty, really polished point guard." The Raptors have another one, and I think, you know, I watched him in a couple of games when he played in the G League, and watched really closely one game. And, you know, I think the simple thing is he hasn't been willing to adapt to be the kind of player that Nick Nurse wants him to be. And, you know, and that's like, he's really looking for someone in that position to be almost frantic, you know, how they play, like just really disruptive and really, you know, cause problems for teams. And for whatever reason, Flynn hasn't, you know, shown the willingness to do that. And I think he's had some moments that he hasn't jumped on. And, but yeah, I mean, I guess your bigger point is it would be nice to have Desmond Bane. Yes. And, you know, and unless something really happens here with Flynn, like, they're going to have to find, they don't have to, right? Like, I mean, they can just kind of roll this out and whatever happens this year.
Well, there is somebody that they're paying, that's, you know, working out at the Miami Heat facility, who plays that position. I'm led to believe, like why is Goran Dragic just allowed to exist in this manner? I know he has higher aspirations than the Raptors, who might be a 5 seed, but like, that guy can actually help this team right now if he played better than he did to start the season.
Yeah, all I can tell you there is the impression I got is, you know, when he was here, his mind was elsewhere. And, you know, what the specifics of that are, I'm not sure. But he was, you know, the Raptors on a West Coast trip, and he sat down with his agent, Bill Duffy, for a long, long talk, I believe, in Sacramento. And, you know, 2-3 days later, he was on his way to Slovenia, I presume. And, you know, and it's pretty telling that with all the roster problems the Raptors were having the last few weeks or months, you know, they never, and the obvious gap we're talking about at point guard, they never have even shown a minute's inclination to bring him back. And I think they would they would be, I think all both sides would be happy at this point to kind of cut ties. But he is an asset in the sense that he's a contract. And, you know, you never know how the trade market's going to shape up. And you would hate to buy Dragic out and all of a sudden have an opportunity to make a deal that you didn't realize was available and not have the contracts to make it happen. So I think that's really how this plays out. You know, maybe there's a scenario you get, you know, a future second round pick for him, but I just don't see that. I think really he's around to be ballast in a potential trade, none of which I'm suggesting is on the horizon. Or, you know, if nothing happens, he'll be bought out. And yeah, we'll see how good shape he's been keeping himself in and how much he can help somebody else.
It is the irony, though, is, as Ben alluded to, though, right, Mike? Like, you, I'm not sure how long you can keep running Fred VanVleet out for 40 minutes a night. You know, maybe you can keep doing that for, you know, he's certainly willing. And but they need, you know, they need somebody like Dragic to, you know, to take some of that load off Fred VanVleet, don't they?
Yeah, I think so. I think they need. I mean, and, you know, they've got kind of workarounds, and you're seeing Scottie Barnes and Pascal Siakam play a lot more point guard, and you know, it's not like Flynn is incompetent, right? Like, he just hasn't quite earned the trust of enough trust to get, you know, a steady 15-20 minute dose. And so, you know, it's the obvious place you need to shore up. And you know, there's it's kind of interesting, right? Like, I mean, there is a school of thought out there that the Raptors should never have done, you know, that they just should have let Kyle Lowry walk in free agency. And then, you know, they would have had the cap space to go and pursue a player and all of that. And, you know, we'll see, really. But right now, you know, so right now that strategy of doing a side trade for Lowry was good for Lowry. You know, like, he got where he wanted to be. He got the money he wanted. You know, but it certainly the benefits you thought you might have got residually from Goran Dragic haven't paid off and likely won't. And Preston's you know, jury's out, right? Like, you can see flashes, but man, you can see a lot of gaps.
Yes.
And you know, and so we'll see. We might not be able to evaluate for that for a little while, but you know, big picture, if the Raptors can't address that weakness of point guard, I mean, you're just basically playing the next 50 games with your fingers crossed, right? Because you know, every metric available tells you when Fred VanVleet's not available, this team suddenly becomes not that good.
Yeah, because you need more than one point guard. So you mentioned Kyle Lowry, and the return game has been moved up a couple of days to February 1st. They play in Miami just before that, so you can't do what the Leafs just did with the Islanders and just, like, swap games, like home games. Heat are back on April 3rd as well. Like, it would take some serious maneuvering, but the NBA has done some serious maneuvering this year. Michael, do you know if there's any even, like, preliminary discussion or any thought within the Raptors about moving that game if the fans are still not allowed in the facility early February?
I just can't conceive of it, Ben. And, you know, I'll be honest, I have not dived too deeply into the schedule, like, matrix of what would happen if, you know, if you moved a game here or moved a game there, and can they play here? And, you know, I spent literally about 30 seconds at it. And I was like, this is pointless. Like, this is just, you know, it's like the amount of conflicts and things that are in place, which looks like an off day isn't an off day. And you know, it's like, so I can't imagine that the NBA is all that worried that Kyle Lowry might end up playing in Toronto and there may not be a full building here or even a half full building. So
I don't like it.
For sure. I mean, they just want to get games in and you know, so I'd be shocked if they kind of moved it.
Mike, just before we let you go, Canada Basketball made a hire today. The women's national team hired a new coach, Victor Lapena, who's from Spain. What do you know about him? What do you think of the hire? And is there any, you know, is there any fallout from the fact that they went outside Canada for the hire?
I can't say I knew anything about him before this morning, but I did speak to our old friend Mauricio Garradini, who's runs basketball for Fenerbahce, the big club in Turkey, where our Victor LaPena is the woman, runs a women's program there, and he said really, really good things, and then kind of, you know, word filters through some players I spoke with, and that, you know, the reputation is very good. Spain is, you know, kind of a almost like the model for a basketball federation in the last 15, 20 years, so very positive, I think. Also the fact they got Noel Quinn, who's you know, head coach of the Seattle Storm, which is like probably the iconic WNBA franchise, and you know, it's all that professional experience plus international experience, both coaching and playing. You know, I spoke to Matt Achanwa, who's hoping to play in her fourth Olympics in 2024 if they can pull all this together. You know, and she was a thought it was great. I mean, I think these coaches really checked a lot of boxes for them, and then was really, really moved about having in Quinn, you know, a successful black woman professional player slash coach as part of the Canadian women's program, which is, you know, you just haven't seen. You know, it's no fault of anyone's, I don't think, but the coaching tree on the women's side especially has been very linear. And it was interesting, I asked Michael Bartlett about that, the CEO of Canada Basketball, and he said, look, you know, this is a step we needed to make. You know, you've got players who are playing in the WNBA, playing the top leagues all over Europe, and you know, they need a coach with a complementary pedigree, I guess. But he did say, look, this is, you know, it's a challenge for the organization is to build their coaching path so that, you know, if and when, you know, this job comes available again, you do have Canadians who have, you know, can kind of meet these kind of criteria. Like on the men's side, the coaching industry has really grown, and you know, there's a lot of guys with a developing range of experiences. That hasn't been quite the exact same scenario on the women's side. So I don't think there's a ton of pushback. I think the players were looking for somebody with these kinds of credentials, and like, you can't fault them. Like, I mean, each of these, both Quinn and LaPena are coming from the highest pedigree you can almost have in the sport.
Michael, good chat. Thanks for doing this. Talk again soon.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
See ya. Michael Grange, Sportsnet Zone. I got to say, I was aware of the Dragic thing, and I've read all about the Dragic thing, and he had the Instagram post where he was working out at the Miami Heat facility, and it deleted because he's, you know, being paid almost $20 million by the Toronto Raptors, traded directly from the Miami Heat. The Raptors are, at worst, like, half decent and in the mix for a play-in spot in the Eastern Conference. They have this deficit at a position where they're paying someone, again, almost $20 million. And this is a guy who did say the things that I said that were translated, and you know what? It was actually Grange who had the first, I think, exclusive with him where he tried to soft pedal that, and it was all well and good, and he showed up, and he stunk out of the gates. Like, he was horrible, and it was, okay, that's fine. He has a track record. Nobody's going to kill him for that. Disappears, working out with the Miami Heat. Raptors have one point guard who's playing 47 and a half minutes a night, and they're paying this other guy. Like, why are people not more upset at this?
That's a very good question. I think those are all good points, Ben. It would seem to kind of fit, right? Like, and you're paying him anyway. And you're right, he was god awful, but he looked like he didn't want to be here, which I guess he didn't. But this is one of those. Well, those mysteries do happen in the NBA every once in a while, though, do they not? Like,
oh, yeah.
Or maybe they just happened to Toronto. I don't know. This isn't the first time.
No, and there's some happening. I mean, the Ben Simmons thing is still well, by the way, cash your ticket if you had Kyrie Irving playing a game before Ben Simmons this year. Congratulations. Yeah. That happened. But now apparently Daryl Morey has expanded his list of acceptable trade acquisition pieces.
Excellent idea. 25. That's why you know they're paying Daryl Morey the big bucks.
I didn't even bring it up with Michael because, yeah, okay, he does actually play point guard. So, yeah, sure. I mean, in theory, could fit a role on this team. I feel like he is so you have to be a desperate, desperate franchise to go after a Ben Simmons at this point, not just with the deficiencies offensively, but what has happened since the end of the postseason last year. But, yeah, he's one of those guys that's hanging out there. John Wall, same deal with the Houston Rockets. So it's not totally unusual, but this is – this is a different scenario. Like, and this guy did try to change the narrative. Like, I referenced the piece with Michael. He said, you know what? That was taken out of context. It was perhaps translated incorrectly. I forget exactly what his excuse was, but it's like, and you know what? The Raptors still, even if they were in this position and in and around the play-in tournament, I bet you they'd still be willing to include him in a trade at the deadline. And he would probably boost his trade capital, trade potential, if he was playing. Like, I just need more of a reason. I need more of an explanation, because this guy was initially afraid of the fan backlash. Now I there should be more, and he should be afraid of it still, even more so. But he's out of sight, out of mind, I guess. They could use him.
They could use him. And you're right. He would boost his trade value if he came and played a little bit, and he would become more than just a contract, which, as Mike said, that's what they're going to trade, right? That's It's one of those balance out an NBA trade kind of situations, and that's what I'm sure he will be, and I'm sure it'll happen in the days between now and the deadline. But it is, yeah, I say I wouldn't hold your breath for this mystery to being solved, though, for some grand explanation, because there's obviously kind of a tacit agreement here on both sides. That he's not playing, we're not going to talk about it, we'll deal with this when we deal with it, and in the meantime, we're just going to pretend it's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, I can guess that he doesn't want to play for this franchise. He's a baby. He wants to play for the Miami Heat. If the NBA is going to investigate the tampering of Masai Ujiri right after free agency, that immediately there's signings and trades consummated, and I think he was dinged with a fine. Like, how is there not going to be an investigation into when Goran Dragic, who again was videotaped working out or took a picture in the Miami Heat facility, if he ends up back in Miami after all this, like there should be a massive inquisition. Anyways, enough of that. But it irks me. Before we break, I do want to talk about this Athletic thing. The Athletic sold finally. We mentioned it a couple of weeks ago that this possibility was percolating, that the New York Times was kind of circling the Athletic, and multiple reports today that it is sold for $550 million. Which seems like a lot, and it's in and around, I think, what people estimated the Athletic might get. There's 1 million subscribers, and the New York Times is trying to get to, I think, 10 million subscribers in 5 years or something, so this aids in that regard. I've been a subscriber to the Athletic. I read tons of sports journalism, as you do as well, Stephen. I mean, some of the best is on our own website. Like, that's not just Homer stuff. Like, sportsnet.ca is the number one site I go to for my sports content. But the Athletic has some good stuff, and they have good writers. They went out and got some, and they let a lot of them go recently too, as they tried to get a little skinnier to be bought for more than $500 million. You're the sports writer. What do you think this means for the industry?
Well, look, I hate to, you know, like I root for the people who write and work at the Athletic, because they've hired a lot of talented people, and not just here in Canada, but all over the place. And they gave people a platform who deserved to have a platform as some of the kind of old media was collapsing. I have a hard time rooting for the vulture capitalists who run it and who now just cashed in, because this was always the game, right? That they were going to build it and cash in. And remember, they were the ones that were talking about how they're going to put all the newspapers out of business. Well, the newspapers, you know, were doing a pretty good job of that themselves, right? They didn't really need these guys to do it, to get them out of the sports game. But, you know, I think they've employed good people. I think the model, they've been giving it away almost the last year, which it's a paywall, but it's the thinnest of paywalls now. It's like $1 a month.
Frustrating if you paid full fare.
Yeah, no, but here's one thing. You know, I know people grouse about paywalls, and they hate paywalls. And you know, this is the kind of the test has been here. Could you sell sports content on that basis? You know, is there a model that works? A Netflix model that works for sports content? Mm-hmm. I think the jury is still out on that. But you know, if you're grousing about, like, where do you think content comes from? The idea that you should, you know, it's like, you know, like stealing movies and things, like. You know, the people who create this stuff should be rewarded, and their work should, the value of their work should be acknowledged, and the rights to that work should be honored. If you're trying to kind of get around it all the time, you're destroying that which you love. So, you know, go ahead and be a, you know, pirate stuff or steal stuff, but if you want to support, you know, content, you know, guy, you know, if people have sites that they write on, that they've started up and you like what they do, support them and pay them. You know, if you want to read good sports writing, you know, The Athletic is a good, you know, I would support them. That doesn't mean you don't go to other places, don't go to other sites. And as you say, our website has been superb. But more is better, right? It's an interesting, you know, the merger with the Times has done some interesting stuff with sports. Mm-hmm. They went to a very different model. They got rid of all their columnists, you know, who were kind of the signature guys in that paper for years. They went to a very much a feature-oriented approach to sport. So it's a, you know, it's not, you know, from a content point of view, it'll be a kind of an interesting merger. And I don't know, you know, I don't know enough about what it could do to boost the Times has what 8 million subscribers worldwide, I think, and they have had a quite successful paywall model, unlike almost every other newspaper in the world. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe the synergies are good. I just wish those creeps hadn't cashed out. But, sorry, yeah. Not to put too fine a point on it.
No, well, and yeah. And hopefully everybody gets to keep their jobs, but yeah, you never know when something like this happens. But yeah, and the New York Times has made big acquisitions before. They bought the Boston Globe for over $1 billion in 93. You know what they sold it for, Stephen, in 2013?
A discount.
Less than that, $70 million. Bought it for over $1 billion, sold it for $70 million. That's called a bad investment. There was a thing called about.com that they bought in 2005 for $410 million, and they sold it for $300 million. So they've made some unwise investments. Here's hoping, as a fan of sports journalism, that this isn't one, and a good thing for the people who work for that publication. Again, I'm a subscriber. All right. Let's talk to John Wertheim next of Sports Illustrated. Novak Djokovic, does he have Wi-Fi? Can he watch Netflix? I'm not sure, but he'll be in that Australian hotel room until Monday, it seems like. We'll talk to John about that next. The Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt, and yes, we are still awaiting the exciting conclusion of Novak Djokovic's travails in Australia. The latest is that this thing is going to be resolved by Monday. The Serbian government, the president, he's gotten involved. Boy, his dad has been vocal. His mom has been vocal. This is turning into a real international incident. And it's, you know, it's not the first time that tennis has found itself in this spot, right? Like, the Peng Shuai situation still exists, and hopefully we will be reminded of it again when people report on the situation in Beijing, China at the start of the Olympics, now less than a month away. I don't know if there's something about this sport in particular that lends itself more to geopolitics, but yeah, you find this often in tennis, Stephen.
Well, this one, yeah, this is an interesting one. Again, I'm not sensing any great groundswell anywhere other than Serbia that's suggesting let him in and let him play. It's, you know, like I think we kind of know where public opinion is in Australia right now. You know, that's the kind of fascinating part. You've got a guy who may be the greatest player of all time, who is on the verge of becoming the greatest Grand Slam winner of all time, and going to a place where he has been incredibly successful, and yet is a pariah there now, because of the way he's played this. Like, you know, if there's some technicality that allows him in, imagine the reception he's going to get or not get. Imagine a year from, well, who knows? I have a hard time imagining a year from now, because I have
imagine
no idea what world that
now
will be. But let's say a year from now they're playing the Australian Open again and Novak Djokovic is returning in a post-COVID world. How are folks going to feel about him? How are folks going to feel about him anywhere now when he walks out onto a court?
No, I think he's the black hat forever, and he doesn't seem like he's that afraid to play that role, to be the bad guy, to be as Kobe did late in his career, like the black mamba, to go from the baby face to the heel. But I think that's what he becomes. And it's not like any of this is necessarily brand new. Like, we know his stance on vaccines. He's been very vocal about it. He had a super spreader event in 2020, but this goes beyond that. And it's, and we were having the conversation with Adnan yesterday. Like, he's tied for the most slams ever, and he's going to get one more, you would think. He's only, what, 35. and it's in an era where nobody has emerged as the next great number one to succeed he and Federer and Nadal. So he's going to get one more, but the feeling of that triumph, it's going to be muted wherever it is, you would think, other than Serbia. Serbia, they're going to have parades upon parades after parades, and they're going to have streets and buildings and everything. They might change the name of the country to Novak Djokovic, but everywhere else, it's hard to see tennis fans really going nuts when he finally breaks the record.
No, it's going to be strange. And, you know, again, we are living through the greatest era in the history of men's tennis. Three of the four greatest players in history probably we're watching right now. And yeah, this is his moment when he is going to kind of put his head above the other two, right? Like that's what we're on the verge of here. Maybe Rafa will win another, stay healthy enough to win another French Open. And, you know, yeah. It's hard to imagine Federer being healthy enough to win another Grand Slam ever at this stage. You know, Djokovic can put some light between himself and the other two guys, except the world may not be cheering him on.
No, I think they definitely won't be. Let's talk to John Wertheim, Sports Illustrated executive editor and senior writer, who is kind enough to join us online right now. How's it going, John?
Not bad. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing all right. Where do we stand on this whole thing now? Because it felt like it was going to maybe conclude yesterday. Now it feels like it's going to hang on until Monday. What are the odds that this ends in anything other than Novak Djokovic heading back to Serbia?
I think it depends how good his lawyers are. But right now we are waiting for this appeal to be heard Monday. So we've got a couple days to rest from the theatrics, and his lawyers can prepare a case. But I would not put my odds on him staying. I just heard him. I think you guys raise a really good point, which is even best case scenario, he stays, he wins the tournament for the 10th time. It still would be such a bummer. I mean, it's just, you know, this guy's on the threshold of history, and he's gonna set the record at this place, and it would be so tainted and so contaminated by all this. I mean, in a weird way, I think the best thing for him might be to say, like, see you next year, but I don't think that's going to happen voluntarily.
I'm trying to imagine him walking out on a court, you know, either to start the tournament or to win the tournament in Melbourne, a city that has gone through, you know, the world's gone through a gruesome 2 years, but the way they were locked down for months and months on end, it's been horrible there, and I'm not sure people here appreciate the difference between, you know, the way they handled it and the way we've handled it in North America. To have him in that city, you know, walk out on a court, a place where he's been extraordinarily successful and, you know, one of the best tennis environments in the world. But the hostility, it would, like, I'm not sure they'd boo him off the court, but I think it would be pretty close to that.
Yeah, I mean, first, you're very kind to call this North America and not differentiate between the U.S. and Canada. Someone asked me that too, and I said, I don't know. I mean, first, tennis doesn't really have a big history of booing. It's unclear still how many fans will even be allowed to attend, which tells you something about what Australia is still going through and what their protocol is. There's a big Serbian population in Melbourne that we've already seen outside Djokovic's hotel. So for every fan that boos, but I just think, imagine Tiger Woods has won the British Open 9 times, and he's going to win a 10th to try and break Jack Nicklaus's record for majors won. And before his plane touches down, the prime minister, you know, Boris Johnson, is already saying, I wish you would leave. All of England is saying, like, boo, stay home. I mean, it's just the set of circumstances. This guy is going to set history. He's won this thing 9 times. I mean, he should be getting, like, a hero's welcome on elephants, and instead he's like enraged the whole country before his plane lands. I mean, it's just it is the strangest set of circumstances, but in some ways it's very much on brand for Novak Djokovic.
Yeah, well, and the last 2 years. But you raise an interesting point, though. I mean, not that he should have ever been allowed into Australia, but maybe this could have been sorted out before he got on an airplane, do you think?
Oh, I mean, I would say maybe it could have been sorted out. I said if only there were an easy, fast, safe, socially responsible way to have avoided this.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
Vaccination like 95% of his peers. But no, I mean, I think the real issue here, and I don't know if this has been reported. I mean, what really happened here is there was this months-long parlor game of will he or won't he, and he sort of did this wink-wink thing, and I'm not saying. And then he had this Instagram post, and instead of saying, hey, I'm going to Australia after all, he says, I got this exemption. The other players that got in on an exemption had, put it this way, but had the good sense just to go to Australia and keep their mouths shut. He sort of did this gloating about this exemption, and the implication was, I'm not vaccinated, we found a loophole, and now I'm going. And I think that was one of the real fatal flaws. I mean, it still is a bit of a mystery how he was even okayed, how he got this exemption. I mean, you're supposed to have an acute medical condition, which, you know, that would be news, and that also that has not prevented him from winning 20 majors. I mean, somebody was telling me, like, their father had – all these anecdotes are coming out now, and people say, look, well, you know, my father had – cancer and you know, an artificial heart, and he can't get this exemption. The other thing is that Djokovic, in theory, there's an exemption if you'd had COVID in the last 6 months. But first of all, Djokovic got COVID in 2020 when he had that super spreader event, you know, in May of 2020. And also, if you sort of do the Instagram sleuthing, it's very unlikely he had COVID in the last 6 months. So I think one of the big issues here is he's gotten vaccinated, but short of that, the fact that he sort of gloated about, hey, we found this loophole, I think that's what really enraged people and also got the government to sort of start. I mean, this, you know, by the time his plane landed, the government had already made up his mind. And I think if he had just gotten on the plane and kept his mouth shut, this wouldn't have happened.
What John, what makes him, you know, what makes him tick? You know, we always talk about his, we you know, kind of his, in contrast to Federer as a personality, or in contrast to Rafa, maybe as a personality, but like, what about, you know, what's happened here is kind of emblematic of what kind of a guy Djokovic is.
I think a big part of this is sort of, you know, geography is destiny. And Roger Federer goes back to Switzerland and he's popular, but he's not the national identity. He's not the first thing people associate with Switzerland. Rafa Nadal is Spanish, but he goes home and he flies his commercial plane back to his island and that's that. A lot of this is just Djokovic is sort of such a central figure in Serbia, in its image to the world, and what people know about this country. I mean, you even saw, like, the Prime Minister of Serbia, we stand with you, Novak, has already weighed in. I just think it's a completely different dynamic. I don't know if you guys ever saw that. There's a great documentary on WeWork, and there's a great line from the film that if you tell a male in his 30s he's Jesus, he's inclined to believe it. And I think a lot of this just stems from the circumstances under which Djokovic plays, what it's like for him when he goes home, the reception he gets. I mean, you see, when you see his fans on social media, he's not just an athlete. We all like our athletes and our teams. But this goes beyond sort of conventional sports fan tribalism. I mean, there's really something. This is a representative of a country. This is a national figurehead. And I think that sometimes distorts it. He's not, people say, oh, you know, tennis has always had bad boys like McEnroe. He's not a bad guy. He's not a jerk. He wants you to like him. I just think there is a bit of sort of delusion and narcissism that sneaks in. Clearly, he has no one around him who's telling him, hey, not a good idea. And I think that's part of this. We talk about how celebrities today are so bland and they have all these media training and image doctors. There's none of that. I mean, the fact that he can botch things so consistently tells you a lot about sort of what power he has, about the people in his orbit as well. But I just think it's such a different dynamic than your conventional athlete who is popular, but they're not carrying the image of the country when they do anything.
Well, and this is a great segue into the quote tweet that you had today, John, talking about tennis being geopolitical, a sport that is very much geopolitical, and whether that's good or bad for the sport. You just threw it out there. Discuss. Now I'm forcing you to discuss it, John. Is it good or bad for tennis that it's become geopolitical?
You know, when women's tennis takes the lead on confronting China and saying not okay, and we don't want to do business in a country that's values are so at odds with ours, it's wonderful. You know, when tennis becomes this referendum on vaccine mandates and on cultural differences and visas, it's less wonderful. Someone asked me, they said, you know, between Naomi Osaka and mental health and what happened with the women's tennis and Peng Shuai in China and now Djokovic, does anyone actually play tennis, or does the sport sort of just exist for these hot button topics? But no, I mean, I think, you know, it is this relentlessly global sport. everyone is their own boss. So it's not, you know, I think what the other thing we're seeing is, you know, it's not the NBA, it's not the NFL, it's not the NHL. Like this, these guys are their own bosses. These guys are all independent contractors. And part of that means they can play when they want to play. And if they want to take a mental health break, they don't have to ask management for permission. But it also means that these guys can really kind of make a mess of things. And it's not a boring sport to cover, but you know, sometimes you wish you were a little bit more about tennis matches and less about sort of issues and policies and governments. And it ain't boring. And I'm telling you, the Australian Open starts in about 10 days. This is not the walk-up free publicity they imagined, but I guarantee more people are talking about Novak Djokovic and potential deportation than, you know, the match is playing out in Perth tonight. So it's never boring in tennis.
Well, and there's a couple of TV sports execs who are kind of hoping things go a certain way on Monday because, yeah, him stepping onto the court would be must-see TV. John, appreciate the time today. Thanks.
As always, thanks, guys.
See you, John. John Wertheim, Sports Illustrated executive editor and senior writer. Yeah, it needs like a Drive to Survive Netflix series. Pro tennis does this with these independent contractors. Seems like there's good enough personalities on both the men's and the women's side. I'd be down for that.
There would be a lot to work with. I'll tell you. Just I would love to, you know, have, if there was fly on the wall all access to the last 72 hours of Novak Djokovic's life. From the, and John's got a great point there, right? You know, like sometimes. You know, it's who's around you and how insulated you are, and you know, no people being willing to say, you know, that's you know, no, don't send that one out about nya. I got an exemption. That's a bad idea. Let's just slip into the country quietly, and go settle into that nice house you rented and hope nobody asks the question until the opening press conference of the tournament, right? Like, you know, sometimes a bunch of yes people, or maybe a whole country full of yes people, are not the best thing. But yeah, imagine. You know, imagine the scene just when the plane landed in Melbourne there. And Mr. Djokovic, could you step inside here? We have a couple of questions for you. Like this is stranger than fiction.
No, it absolutely is. So we have some news about this upcoming Canada World Cup qualifier that will be played at Tim Hortons Field. Is scheduled to be played at the end of January at Tim Hortons Field because who knows? Nothing's certain these days. In a way, it's maybe good news that Alphonso Davies just contracted COVID and is seems to be fine. So the idea of him being reinfected before this match seems very unlikely from the science that we understand. But Canada Soccer canceled their camp in this month, which is, part of it has to be keeping these guys COVID-free so that they can play this match at the end of the month.
They were going to go to Florida, I think, and have a warm weather camp. And I'm not sure how many of the guys would have been there because, you know, it depends on whether they can get their releases outside of the window, the international window. But, you know, obviously it's a very important stretch here for Canada and, you know, an enormously important stretch, these three matches. So that's out the window. So that's not ideal. It's not like other countries aren't going to be able to train. And you wonder, again, how much they're going to be able to train going in. And those matches, they can't really move them, Ben, just because of the...
Yeah,
because the window in the international schedule that you have to play when the players are free, I don't think that unless everything gets shifted, and I don't maybe but I my guess is they'll do whatever they can to get those three matches in this window, and then the question becomes in Ontario, in Hamilton, outdoors. You know, right now I think it's 1,000 people, but that's the rule for indoor sports. I don't know if they would modify that rule outdoors. There's not really anywhere else to play in Canada. Nothing is going to really improve that situation. I think, like, I hate to say it, but them playing in an almost empty stadium in the end of January in Hamilton is, I think, probably the most realistic possibility right now.
No, I think it's absolutely the most likely. And now, I don't have any idea what the testing policy is for CONCACAF, or maybe it's FIFA that's in charge of all this. But we can, you know, you can talk about the Raptors having some G League players in a game that they lose by 45 points in Cleveland to a Cavaliers team that's half decent, but they probably could have beaten on any other given night. And, you know, maybe it'll be the difference between them getting into a play-in tournament spot or out of the play-in tournament and into a real playoff spot. It's just one of 82, though. Or the Leafs going through what they went through and, okay, they lost a couple of guys. Actually, probably benefited them being off for a couple of weeks. Everybody got healthy, but... And it's a big season for them, but they're going to be in the playoffs. And if you finish first, you get Boston, or you finish second, you get Tampa. Who really cares? It is crazy, Stephen, that COVID and contracting COVID and all these athletes are vaccinated, being at home either with the sniffles or asymptomatic. And hopefully Canada's put itself in a spot where this isn't the case. But you know, coming up empty in this international window could be the difference between making a World Cup and changing the future of an entire sport in a country and not to make too big a deal of it, but I don't know if that is.
No, it's a big deal. Like it's like, yeah, there's, you know, it is a big deal, and some of those guys, you're going to have to get them into the country in order to play this match. Some of them are here, but a bunch of them aren't. You know, just getting them across the border and then through those testing protocols. Like, let's start with that, because they'll have to pass a PCR test when they arrive. You know, anybody that's coming from anywhere other than the United States, it's hard to imagine nobody will be COVID positive because. You take a group of 25 people in the world right now, it's hard to find anybody, any group that's going to be entirely COVID negative. Now, the Americans, all the other teams, they're going to face the same deal, right? So that is the one thing. Everybody's playing for the same rule book here, but it's not what we'd hope for.
One more thing before we go. So it's kind of a two-parter. One, God, I shouldn't bring up Twitter so much, but did you know Roger Clemens is on Twitter now? He just started up a Twitter account.
Oh, good.
It's really, really very nice and good. I wonder if it's to, you know, it might be for the Veterans Committee, because I remember it was a couple of weeks ago I did share that he, along with Barry Bonds, were tracking towards being inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Of course, you need 75% of the vote to get in, and this is their last year of eligibility. While that is true, they were tracking towards that the guy who does all the pre-actual announcement tabulation, Ryan Thibodeau, it's actually like there's no chance that they're getting in because they needed to gain a certain amount of votes from a certain amount of voters, and it's not going to happen. So, no, Roger Clemens, Barry Bonds will not be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. I know that intrigues you immensely because you're a huge proponent of the Baseball Hall of Fame Museum.
Well, I look forward to seeing which pure souls get in their stead, because I'm sure they will be, their characters will be unimpeachable. We'll see. It'll be an afternoon of talk radio. That's what it will be, right?
Yeah, and I can't wait to be back to have that conversation. You know what? I still think they're getting in because Roger's going to fire off some good tweets in the next 10 years or something. He's going in the Veterans Committee, and maybe Barry Bonds will follow his lead. I think he's on Instagram. Get on Twitter, Barry. All right, I'm going to take some time off.
Yes, I just had time off. Well deserved. Well deserved.
Thank you. So Arash will be back tomorrow and next week. I'll see you after that. This has been the Fan Drive Time. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt.